I was asked years and years ago by a Wall Street Journal reporter what my definition of creativity was. And I said, well, it's abstract and it's moving and it's the weather and it's Buddhism and it's anything but being able to be tying it down. And so, but I said, if I was forced to say one thing that I think creativity is, it's really looking at more stuff, being open to more of the world and kind of opening your kind of frame of reference to see more, be inspired more, observe more, absorb more, and then thinking about it and doing something with that. So I said, look at more stuff and think about it harder. And the next day it was in print and it became our website and became a mantra and really much more of a philosophy. But it's a good one. It's an easy one for people to access. And I think this topic needs those easy on-ramps. It's not – we don't need to overcomplicate this idea of thinking about things in unique ways.
Because I feel like, I'll just be honest, I look at too much stuff already.
Yeah. No, there's no question. And so as a curator, I talk a lot about curation. And my job as a curator for executives or for companies or for institutions is to really edit the excellence of the world, find the best things that help them see their world differently. And so take the best of the world and put it in front of a person or an organization so that they can, in fact, use that source of inspiration to see through it as a lens to see their world in a different way. Example. Yeah, so I believe in this idea of human library, and I believe that everybody is a book, and that if you're not a big reader, you don't have to read. You can just check people out, and it's a Scandinavian – it's actually a Danish idea from the 1800s where there was – 1600s, I'm sorry, and there was a thing called the human library, and you would walk into this physical building, and the human library was filled with people of different sex beliefs and different political beliefs and economic beliefs and all the way across the board, and you could check them out and actually have a conversation with them as a book. And so as a way to curate, I now find interesting people, whether it's an ethnographer or a military general or a theater person or a policeman or otherwise, and I have that source of content talk to the audience. And then I say, as the curator, I've put something in front of you to say, so I heard them say, so what that might mean to me. And so people can be content and people can be something that you curate in terms of editing a great group of people to be putting in front of another group of people so they can see and hear their story for different effect.
How do you get people to be open to that? Because that's the other trick, isn't it?
Yeah,
we're all so comfortable being around everybody who thinks and looks the way we do.
Yeah, I think that that's a big – it's a great question. I think the reason why people are more receptive is because when you go outside, I believe that there are kind of three ways of looking at more stuff. It's direct, indirect, and tangential. And direct is – if you're a pharmaceutical company and I brought in a bunch of pharma executives or pharma R&D people or people in the medical space, they'd say, I know, I've been around, I'm familiar with, and this is my world. And if you go indirect, it might be people in business or industry, and they'll say, well, I understand how business works, and I understand how industry works, and I understand how supply chain works, and you can kind of go to those equations. But if I bring in tangential, it might be an artist, or it might be a theater person, or it might be a culinary expert. And so by looking so outside of yourself, you can't reference it back to the world in which you know so well. So you look at it purely, and then when the simple question's asked, how might I take what I learned from them and apply back to me, you don't have qualifiers on top of it because it's not an easy one-to-one reciprocity kind of equation. It's kind of they're so outside of me that I can use them as a way to be inspired to look more closely at who I am.
And inspiration's key, right? You believe inspiration is really the lifeblood of everything.
Yeah, I really do. And you present that beautifully. I do think it's the lifeline of everything. And I was actually coming back from a radical sabbatical. I spent a month every year with my family in New York. And we were driving down 95 and we were just going through D.C. And I said, Jill, I just got to stop and talk to a friend who works at HCA, the big healthcare institution. And I walked in and I said, Marge, I'm just thinking about the idea of how inspiration is really important. And I had been creatively consulting her and innovatively consulting her and her team for several years. And she said, it's everything because inspiration is the fuel that you actually create off of to innovate off of. And so inspiration is the fuel. And by virtue of that fuel, you then can create. And by creating, you will innovate or manifest something. So it doesn't have to be linear because it is more of a holistic equation. But inspiration is that kind of intangible that we often overlook. And when you look at executives or companies or organizations that want to create, they'll often kind of just say, let's go into the creative session. But with no new inputs, you won't get a new output. And so no new inspiration, no new output, because you're looking at the same things in the same way. It's kind of obvious to me, and kind of an epiphanic moment when the executives see how this outside stuff helps them see.
I want to read something you've said about the mood of a company, or it could be an organization, I'm sure, too. And what you said about that is it's important to foster the right mood at the company when you walk into the place. Does it feel like great things can be created here?
It's, I think, the most vital role of a leader. And I was at the Montana Nonprofit Association event this morning, and Liz, the executive director, stood up and she created the right mood. She was comical and kind and empathetic, and in context of everyone in the room, she was completely in the moment. She wasn't reading a script. She was being herself and being present. And the entire mood from minute two was created and conditioned for the next 2 days in which they'll encounter, because Liz created the mood. And a leader's job is to really do a few things: tell great stories, capture good stories and retell those stories, and to create the mood. And when they walk in an organization, it's their job to almost put their finger in their air, almost gauging the mood or the weather, and actually move the weather pattern in order to be the weather pattern it needs to be. I can vividly remember driving into my organization play for many, many years. And as I drove in and walked past all the cars of the associates, because I parked at the last parking spot as opposed to the first parking spot to give them the closer ones, I'd walk by all of their cars. And as I walked by all of them, I was thinking about who was in the office already and what mood they might be in based on what soccer game they had with their children the night before, what fight they might be on their spouse, what deliverable they didn't get out the day before to the client. And I'd have a understanding of what mood might be in the room before I walked in the room. And then when I walked in, I'd feel it, and then I'd adjust accordingly to make it a better mood. If leaders just did this, it would set and release so much potential in an organization and its culture. It's staggeringly obvious, but people don't do it.
You talked about being present. Another thing you have said, and I'll quote, is, "I wish more people were real. I wish more people would allow themselves to be themselves."
I just got done talking to some students here at the university, and one of the girls, I said, "So at 30 seconds, give me a feedback on what you guys heard me say in the last hour." And she said, "I'm glad you gave me permission to be myself." And I teared up, and she teared up, and I said, "I only want you to know one thing from this last hour, is that everybody in the world wants you to be more of who you are. And forever, anyone who holds you at bay for not being who you are or doesn't allow you to be who they are, shame on them. Because all I want from you as a young person that can change this world is to be authentic and be yourself. Be authentic and be yourself." And I said it 10 times. And I think that not enough people have that gift that my mom and dad gave me. I am completely aware of all that I am not good and not good at and not aware of, and sometimes out of turn on. And I'm also very aware of things I'm really great at and things that I'm really conscious of and things that I do well, because they just made me authentic to who I am and who I'm not. And so I get to walk into that every day with a headwind as opposed to I'm not a tailwind as opposed to a headwind. And people that aren't authentic face a very, very difficult day. It's a tough day. And so I just wish for that. And my biggest thing I want for my two children that are 10 and identical twins is the fact that they just grow up that way.
Well, I have been speaking with the very real Andy Stefanovich. He's a creative consultant here to speak to the Montana Nonprofit Association Conference. Andy, fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be on the program and love your programming.